Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi, this is Genuinely Grace. Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast. And as you know, July is my 18-month anniversary of the Alcohol Free Life podcast. So I was going to just run a bunch of archive episodes and get, you know, let you have another chance to hear some of those archive episodes. And I'll still do a couple of those. And we have some naughty alcohol-free sparkling wine to give away, courtesy of the amazing guys at Naughty. So we're going to be drip-feeding those through the month as well. So make sure you follow me on Instagram to grab one of those bottles of Naughty AF. There's lots more competitions, by the way, if you go over to thesoberclub.com. And obviously, check out thesoberclub.com. Anyway, you know the stuff we do there. It is a rocking membership, and we have some amazing content over there. However, this is what I'm getting to. Today's guest, I couldn't wait, really. I couldn't wait until the archive stuff was done before I shared this with you, because I was just so totally thrilled to get to interview Denise Welch. She's just such a star. And the new book is such a powerful book. It's going to make such a massive difference to so many people's lives. So it's all self-explanatory. We know who Denise is, just so well known in the UK and worldwide, I'm guessing. So enjoy this interview. It's quite long. It's really in depth. And Denise has got so much to share, such a fabulous, unique take on depression. The book is The Unwelcome Visitor, Depression and How I Survive It. Enjoy the interview. So, so thrilled to speak with you, Denise. I don't think you need a lot of introduction. You're so well known as an actor and TV personality and Loose Women, of course. And it was lovely to chat to you on Steve Wright in the afternoon. Yes. And I know you've been doing just so much publicity, which is just fantastic. And this book, as we were just saying off air, just helping just so many people, because you're bringing out into the open a topic that even today, really, we just don't talk about enough, do we? I mean, 10 years ago, we probably wouldn't have spoken about it at all. But even now, it's not that much.
I know, it's unbelievable, because people do speak out about it, you know, and if you Google books on this subject, there are many. But I think that for a lot of people, there's certain people that have their voice. So, for example, Stephen Fry and Ruby Wax have been forerunners in this field. But the thing about them is they've done wonderful documentaries and brilliant, brilliant books. But my audience, Betty from Bolton, wouldn't necessarily relate to Oxbridge-educated Ruby and Stephen. Mm. You know, I'm more of a sort of a woman of the people because of the type of shows that I do, like Loose Women, where we all bare our souls. And I've been doing that show for 18 years, and I've shared my life, the good, the bad, and the ugly on there. So people feel they know me, whether they like me or not, they know me. And I started with this illness, which is clinical depression. You said, you know, 10 years ago, I got poorly, firstly, 31 years ago. Mine started when I gave birth to my first son, Matthew. And before that, I had had no psychiatric illness, mental illness, nothing. If I said I was depressed, it meant in the way that we, you know, a lot of people say that.
Feeling blue, yeah.
It's only out of ignorance, but it's not, you know, you can't expect people to understand what clinical depression feels unless they've had it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it completely blindsided me when I was this excited, healthy, blooming woman in pregnancy. You know, you hear about these women who bloom in pregnancy, and that was me. My hair was great. My skin was great. I had energy. I loved every minute of my pregnancy. I was in a happy marriage at the time. So basically, I was blindsided by getting severe postnatal depression to the point that I was hospitalized. And if I hadn't had the family that I do, including my dear old dad who's just trying to get through there, if I hadn't had my mum and dad and the family that I do, I don't honestly know where or if I would be here, Janie, to be honest. It was so, that may sound dramatic, but it is the truth. Because one of the things that I try to get over is that I think the reason that my book is selling well and the reason that I am getting these amazing messages, really life-changing messages from people, is because possibly because I've spoken out about the illness for so long, I have a way apparently of explaining it as it is. And even to those people who don't understand it, apparently if they listen to me, they get a better understanding. And maybe it's because I'm an actress, I don't know what it is, but or just that I've talked about it for a long time. Because 30 years ago, I would have given anything to have my book. Mm-hmm. I feel I've written a book that I needed. And that's what spurred me on with it, really. And there was nobody around. There was nobody on the television talking about mental health. There was nothing, you know, at that time, print media was really our main source of material for anything like that.
Yeah.
And there would be, in a magazine, all of the magazines were the typical, wonderful, happy mother with the smiling baby. And of course, you felt incredibly inadequate if you weren't like that. Mm. And yet there would be a tiny little piece at the bottom of page 94, which said that if you feel the baby blues are lasting rather a long time, go and see your GP. My GP, when I was catatonic in her waiting in her surgery with my mum, said, well, I had 5 children, dear, and I just didn't have time to get depressed, is what she said to me. And unfortunately, that she was not alone in that that way of thinking.
Well, it's ignorance,
then.
Isn't it?
It's ignorance. Mm. And my grannies, funnily enough, my granny's generation were the least understanding. And I've done a lot of, obviously, I've talked to thousands of people over the last 30 years, and men and women. But if you spoke about postnatal depression, which hadn't long actually been given a name, nor had premenstrual syndrome, I spent a lot of time with a doctor called Katarina Dalton, who actually had given these things a name. And so my granny's generation, it would be, well, we just had to get on with it. Yeah. We just had to pull up our bootstraps. But then you'd say, Granny, what happened to my Auntie Vera? And she'd say, she went to make money after the birth.
Yeah.
And that's what happened.
Yeah.
That generation, they were institutionalized.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
For probably undiagnosed postnatal depression, menopausal symptoms, which can create the same hormonal imbalance. You know, so it, of course it existed, but people didn't like to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book's called, I love the title, because just in the title it sounds, doesn't it really, The Unwelcome Visitor, Depression and How I Survive It. And we'll talk in a moment about a little bit more about how it came about by you sharing your story. But I'm just really interested, and I hope this question doesn't sound too ignorant, but it's better that I ask it.
Yeah, of course.
But so... Are you saying then that because of the postnatal depression, there was actual changes, neurological changes to the brain that meant that you then, for there on after, had bouts of clinical depression? So it's not linked, in your case, to circumstances and stuff that's going on in your life. It's a neurological imbalance.
So my depression started as postnatal depression, as do many women's depression episodes. I would also like to say to anybody pregnant or thinking about being pregnant or just having had a baby, most women who suffer postnatal depression will make a full recovery. It is completely possible to have postnatal depression and it never darken your doors again. So I never want to worry women about that. I just want to say, but if it does happen, there is now help that there wasn't when I was poorly.
Yeah.
We have Google for a start. There is always a support group, a community that will help you through until you can access professional help, because obviously the mental health waiting lists are, it's a tsunami at the minute.
Yeah.
But anyway, so, but other people's depression starts for completely different reasons, but the end result is the same. Clinical depression is clinical depression. The brain, there's a chemical chaos originated by hormones with me, but it took me 20 years to have someone say, the origin of your depression was hormonal and you are so lacking in estrogen, said Professor Studd, I don't know how you've survived. Right. Prior to that, nobody would. And it's like, well, hang on a minute. I have given birth to a human being which has formed in my body and come out of my foo-foo. And you're telling me that there couldn't possibly be some chemical hormonal chaos that comes on.
Yeah.
So this is what the medics say, even though, and I have great respect for many, many people I've learned from over the years, but a lot of people didn't have a clue, that there is a hormonal chaos when you have a baby, of course, which will result in 80% of women in the baby blues, where you have a few days of complete irrationality, emotions, you feel it's overwhelming, you know, understandable. And then gradually the hormones balance. Of course, your life will never be the same, but in a wonderful way. But with some people, the drop in estrogen after childbirth, particularly apparently those who have a wonderful pregnancy like I did, an incredibly almost euphoric pregnancy, which of course at the time I thought was wonderful. Now that may be a slight red flag for people. Plus, when I had the baby and I took him home after a long, arduous labor, but I don't think it was anything to do with the birth. My mum did for a time, but I don't. It was long and hard. And they should have intervened a bit before, but anyway, never mind. So I had him and then took him home on the Wednesday from the Saturday. On the Friday it all started. So I had a panic attack for no reason, because I wasn't an anxious mum. Mm. The hospital said to me I was the only mum that didn't pull the worry cord at night, you know, going, oh, I wasn't. I was aware I didn't think he was getting enough milk, but I wasn't anxious. I just felt odd.
Yeah.
I felt like everything was happening around me. And then out of the blue, I had a panic attack. And it was the first one, Jamie, that I'd ever had. And
it's been really frightening.
It was so terrifying. And it was like when you are about to, you think you're going to crash in your car.
Mm.
And you think you're going to crash and your heart is like this. But you pull over to the side, realize the danger's gone, breathe, and you're okay. It was like the point of impact never going away. And when I woke up in the morning after maybe, well, a couple of hours sleep, the whole lactation process had gone. So I had gone from having full boobs, you know what a woman's like when her milk comes in, full boobs to nothing, spaniel's ears, overnight. Mm. And now that would be a massive red flag. Mm. The midwife came around, who I didn't know, and said to me, very unusual, which you don't want to hear when you've just had a baby. Very unusual. Normally this only happens if a spouse or a baby dies. So I suggest you just go out and get some bottles, but very disappointing. That's what I've heard.
Wow.
Anyway, thank God I had my mum. But the point being is that my raison d'etre, if you were, is to try and find a parity between the way we treat and talk about physical health the same as mental health.
Yeah.
And also to try and describe the difference between what normal people would say, well, why are you more depressed than me? So an example I give in the book is this. Years ago, 15 years ago on Loose Women, we had a panelist that came on sometimes, the actress Terry Dwyer. And her dad was terminally ill and was dying. And she was devastated. And so she said to me, so what makes your depression? I asked her to ask it like this. She said, why then is your depression worse than my depression? And I said, no, it's not worse. I said, but if you went home tonight and your mum said, the hospital have said they found a cure for dad and he's going to recover, would your depression go? And she said, well, of course it would. I said, well, mine wouldn't. Depression depresses every single thing. So there's another thing that they say all the time, which is persistent sadness. I can't tell you, Janie, how unpersistent sadness it is. I have had many, many, many bouts of sadness, as we all have during the lockdown. Mm. This insecure world we're living in, unparalleled. You know, I've had feelings of overwhelming sadness about what we're bringing our kids into. And that sadness, when my mum died 8 years ago, I was sad. I was bereft. I was grief-stricken. But I didn't get my depression. And when you are depressed, you can't feel love. You can't feel sadness, you can't feel happiness, anger, rage, frustration, nothing. You are dead inside. And therefore, that's why people take their own lives, because they can't stand the pain of deadness.
Yeah.
You know, and most people who take their own lives don't want to die, they want to stop the pain, which of course I know we'll talk about, because that led on to me self-medicating.
totally. I mean, you're right. You do have a really good way of explaining it. And it is so difficult to understand for people who haven't experienced it, but so important that we know. I mean, my mum had mental illness, so I lived with it as a child, but I didn't understand it.
No, of course.
And even now as an adult, I sometimes think back and I think, why didn't my mum know that she was ill? Well, I mean, of course she did, but the I suppose it's this, as you say, with this ridiculous definition between a physical illness and a mental illness. But
well, I always say as well, I know, and I always say the thing is, when I am poorly, there's also a physical manifestation of serious mental illness, of depression, mm-hmm. and which used to be called melancholia, of course, historically, and the thought of suffering from it then is just, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
But once my depression was so bad that it was so thick, my hands started to lock as though in a sort of rheumatoid arthritis, I would imagine, and my face twisted to the side. And my mum got the doctor out to me at midnight in the days that doctors came out at midnight.
Yeah.
And he said to my mum, this is the worst physical manifestation of depression I've seen for many a year. We're going to have to take her in for ECT, which we call electric shock treatment.
Yeah, yeah.
And they didn't because I started to come round. But the fact is, I wasn't scared of going for that. I was desperate to go for that. I was desperate to go for anything that would make me better.
Yeah.
You know, they told me at one point that I might have temporal lobe epilepsy because of the way I described the whoosh that can come on me within 30 seconds. And this doctor said, oh, you seem to describe to me temporal lobe epilepsy. He said, but if you have this, you know, you won't be able to drive, you lose your license. I didn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
All I wanted was, let it be temporal lobe epilepsy.
Feel better.
Not that obviously that's a terrible condition. But it was like, I wanted someone to say, we've been misdiagnosing you. You've got that. And this is the pill to make that better. That's what I wanted.
How common is this then, Denise? How many people have, you know, I don't
very,
know,
very
no numbers, but is it really
very,
as bad?
Very,
my goodness.
Very common. It's so common. But the thing about it is that not only do those of us who have it have a crippling, debilitating, isolating, potentially terminal illness, we have to still prove that we have it.
Yeah.
An example being, nobody listening to this show would think of going up to a person in a bed who has, dare I say it, cancer, something really serious, and say to them, well, you look fine to me.
Yeah, put yourself together.
You've had this for a month now. Do you know what I would do is I'd get up, put your trainers on, get yourself out for a bloody good run and you'll feel better. Nobody would say that. And yet you can't see that person's cancer. My mum lived with cancer for 20 years. Brilliantly. You couldn't tell she had it, but we still accept that she had it and accept how terribly ill that is.
Yeah.
And that's why we read the tragic headlines, because we still have to prove. And of course, that's why so many people self-medicate take drugs and self-harm, because they're trying to get the pain away from their head. And the ultimate is sadly suicide.
Absolutely. Tell us about the link for you with alcohol then, because obviously a lot of people I work with, hugely appreciative of the book that you've written, because they too were drinking, you know, for years to numb the pain. And I'm guessing that's exactly what happened for you. So what happened for you? How long were you drinking for? And did there come a point when you realized that the drinking and the mental health issues were linked in some way?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I was always, before Matty was born, I was a social drinker. I was a bit of a party girl, you know. My mum and dad were kind of social animals. They had me and my sister Debbie when they were very young. They were like 22 when they had me. So rather than leave me, they had their friends around the flat. So they had, in my child's eye view, a normal size flat. I've been back to it. It's about this big, but you know, my memories are of this party-filled flat. And apparently me walking downstairs with a pen between my fingers at 9 years old going, can we go to the Rex, which was this hotel down in Tynemouth. So I was always surrounded by, you know, party people. So I loved to drink, and I would, you know, get pissed with me mates sometimes, and but only in a, I guess I drank in the same way that everybody else did. There was certainly no element of a problem with it. I didn't need alcohol. It was something I did to make a night more fun. Fast forward to having Matthew. Now, initially, I couldn't drink, I couldn't eat. I lost 2 stone in 3 weeks. My mum had to feed me and try to keep me fed with Complan and stuff. So anything like that was out of the picture. And really, I would say that my drinking became a problem probably when Matty was about 7. And then I started doing Coronation Street. And so bearing in mind, my illness was sometimes there and sometimes not. The episodes would come. Trouble is with mine is they come endogenously most of the time. So I have no control over when they come. And that's the frightening thing.
Absolutely no warning, nothing, no lead up to it.
And I think one of the things that's really, Janie, resonating with people in my book is people who say, oh my God, for years people have said to me, well, what do you think's bringing it on?
Yeah, you must have known. Something. It must have been something you ate.
Yeah. You're not eating properly, you're doing this. And I've said, it's an illness. And sometimes there's no reason. When my mum died, I didn't get depression. Last year, the videos we'll talk about that spawned this was me driving up to the Northeast in a fun-filled car to see my sister and her foster kids and the unwelcome visitor came. But the drinking. I was doing Coronation Street, and it was at the time when 24 million people watched each episode, pretty much, you know, a third of the country, maybe more. I was used to a little bit of recognition because I'd done like Spender and Soldier and things like that. But Coronation Street was kind of mind blowing. And I was in my late 30s then. And I was terribly homesick because my husband and Matthew lived in the Northeast. The work schedule was mammoth. And my illness was quite prevalent, which I was talking the talk, but not walking the walk. So I was telling people that you should speak out openly about this, but not doing it myself. Mm. Because a soap opera or a long-running drama is a machine.
Yeah, of course.
And it needs every single component. And if you are a lead part of that and you go, the whole thing can collapse. Mm. Or so I thought. Hindsight, I would have said I'm really poorly.
Were you on medication at that point, Denise?
Yeah, I've always been on medication.
You were. Yeah,
okay. I always will be on medication.
Sure.
I've never been on tranquilizers. Again, we have this Victorian image, well, not even Victorian image, of, you know, people in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in white robes shuffling around waiting for Nurse Ratched to come. It's not like that.
No.
I have an antidepressant which replaces the chemicals that are missing in my brain, like you would if you had insulin for a diabetic.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was under a lot of pressure, and I knew that I would be going home. I would be dealing with Matty, who I'd moved down to the north. This is self-diagnosis. Mm. And I was incredibly stressed by everything. And I was dealing with underlying depression a lot of the time, whilst meant to be like this, because I was suddenly thrust into the public as this devil woman, and everybody loved to hate her. And I was in every magazine and everything. And I was really struggling. Mm. And I started to drink. And it was my leap between moderate party drinking and alcoholic drinking was very quick. Mm. And also during Coronation Street, and I tend not to talk about this a lot simply because the word cocaine has a really inflammatory thing on the press. They know that I did it, but I feel comfortable talking to you because I know that you know. You have lived experience of drinking anyway.
Absolutely.
And so bearing in mind, if I was going to do drugs, Janie, I would have done them as a young'un when everybody was doing drugs. You know, it's not like we couldn't get them. You know, it never interested me. It never, not weed, not nothing. You know, I was a barley wine in the park girl, and I was happy with that. It really didn't bother me. It wasn't on my radar. And bearing in mind, I've been in the business quite a long time by then, so it was around. And I was having a terrible episode. And somebody said to me, you know, this will make you feel better. And I went, oh, I'm not interested in that. And they said, no, but it'll make you feel better. And it did.
And that was cocaine.
Immediately. Yeah, immediately. Immediately for 40 minutes.
Right. Mm. Yeah.
And that was, and the thing is, I never make any excuses for my behavior. But there are reasons for it.
Yes, absolutely.
And so not excuses, but reasons. And that was my downfall. And that was how I felt I was getting through. And then, of course, what was happening was that was perpetuating the depression.
Yeah.
So I was on the treadmill for pretty much 15 years. Yeah. Because I was so terrified of the come down that I would then be doing that again.
Yeah.
And also, I am a good actress.
Yeah.
So I could pull the wool over people's eyes a lot of the time. Not my mum's. If I'd been on television and I could be sitting on Loose Women in a drama series, I've watched things I've done in dramas before when I've been fucking brilliant and I can't remember doing those scenes.
Mm.
And I can't remember them because I know where I was the night before.
Yeah.
I would go on Loose Women when I'd had no sleep and I would be going, and hello, if I was anchoring, you know, hello and welcome to Jamie, who is on the show today to talk about her battles with this, da 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 da. And my mum would have left a message on my phone in my dressing room saying, you're not well, are you? To see it in my eyes.
Wow.
And I have a lot of guilt. People say to me, you know, what another thing I try to say to people is, why are you feeling guilt about having a mental illness? You have as much chance of getting this as you have of getting cancer. You have no choice over it. But what I do feel guilt about is the way that I dealt with it. And I wish I had sought help sooner, but the right help wasn't out there for me.
No, absolutely.
It just wasn't, Janie. And there was a time when I went to Turkey with my family and I got really, really drunk. Louis was a toddler. Matthew was maybe, I don't know, about 15 or something. And the next day, my depression was so thick, I could feel this starting again. And I screamed and said to my mum, I want to go home and I'm going to stop drinking because stopping drinking is going to stop my depression. And I remember mum and dad stayed with Louis. Tim took me home to England. I phoned Kevin Kennedy, Curly Watts from Coronation Street. They're amazing in the recovery world, Janie. Kevin and Claire, if ever you get the chance to talk to
them. Really? Oh, wow, I'd love to. Thank you for that.
They run an amazing recovery and addiction centre in Brighton, so I'll connect you.
Oh, wow, I'd love to talk to them. Oh, I'd love to.
They're amazing. They're amazing. And so I phoned Kevin, and because I had been with him when he was getting sober, because we both had issues at Corrie. Not because of Corrie. Corrie was wonderful. It was just that was the time.
Yeah.
And anyway, so Kevin took me to AA and I felt, I'm an alcoholic, I've gone to AA and all will be well. It just wasn't. I stopped drinking for 18 months, but the reason I stopped was because I thought it would cure my depression.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course it didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
So after 18 months, and also my husband didn't stop drinking, and we know that's difficult.
Yeah, it's very difficult when your partner is not.
Very difficult. And yeah. I'm not saying that he was coming in fally doon drunk, as we call it in Newcastle, but you know how when someone's had 3 pints and you're sober, you want to punch them in the face. End of story. And so anyway, I could go on for hours about this. And, you know, sorry, I'm waffling on. But basically, after 18 months, I made the decision, in my words, to step off the wagon. Mm. I wasn't going to fall off it. I was stepping off it because I felt that I had my drinking under control.
Yeah.
It wasn't curing my depression, but I knew how to do it. Within 4 weeks, I was a disaster.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
And it took to meeting Lincoln 10 years ago and us both getting sober to pretty much change my life.
Yeah, amazing. There's so much I want to ask you. I'm conscious of time. But what's really interesting, you know, we talked earlier about how when you used to rock up to doctors, people in the medical profession with the postnatal depression, they just didn't get it. They just didn't get the link. They didn't, it's not their fault. They just didn't get it. They didn't know about it. Well, exactly the same is clearly true even now about the link between alcohol and depression, mental health. So all those years that you were drinking to numb this pain, I'm guessing nobody ever asked you or really challenged you or really had a proper discussion about the link.
Everything about me stopping drinking was my behavior.
Yeah, but they were diagnosing you and continuing to give you medication and everything else that was going on, but not noticing the effects of the alcohol.
I did hide a lot. I did hide a lot. You know, if you've had an alcohol problem, you hide a lot.
You lie to the doctor,
and,
of course.
And yeah, of course. And also, I was, you know, again, I don't blame this, but it was a contributing factor. I was hacked by the press from 2001 to 2007. So I just thought I was incredibly unfortunate that every time I went out and came out of a nightclub going, you know, that the press were there. Well, of course I was being hacked, but not only that, it made me none of us knew we were being hacked. So it caused a massive distrust within the whole of your friendship circle. So I ended up being friends with people who were just assholes. They were hangers on, but I didn't trust anybody. You know, so it was like, well, I might as well be hung for a sheep as a fucking lamb, you know. And of course, the people I hurt, the only people, as you know, that hold the mirror up to you, you push out against, which is your family and the people who love you.
Yeah.
And they're the only ones who say, and, you know, like my sister would say, and I'd go, oh, my God, you know, Polly fucking perfect, just because you only have two glasses of wine and you nearly pass out. I mean, that was what it was. And it was purely concern for me. But because she knew me so well, she could say it in a more aggressive tone that makes you push back like that. I haven't got a problem. I'm just having to keep the whole family together. I'm having to do all the work for everybody. That's why I have a drink.
Yeah.
All of that.
Yeah.
And of course, I have massive guilt over Matty. Matty and I are very strong. We have a great relationship. But we have talked about, you know, it's hard having a mom who, you know, who drinks a lot.
Mm. Well, you're not present. You're not able to be present for your kids.
It's my one massive regret, actually.
Absolutely, same as me.
And the thing is, Janie, I don't know. I wasn't an alcoholic who literally woke up in the morning and, you know, moved the cleaning stuff aside to get the vodka like this. I wasn't that kind of alcoholic. So, you know, my kids went to school. They were always fed and dressed and we had some wonderful times. But it was almost like I lived a double life as well, because a lot of my work was in London.
Yeah.
So that was when I just went absolutely crazy. Yeah. And I wish I could redo Matty's childhood. Louis, I mean, having said that, you know, he does say, but Mum, if you hadn't been a bit rock and roll, I wouldn't be in the band. I mean, and I guess that is
exactly,
the case. Yeah. Because if he tried to form a band with me and Lincoln, who want to watch true life crime and eat a crumpet and be in bed by 10, he would have had no bloody chance. And obviously Louis was about 9 when we got sober. So he's had a sort of different, you know, a different experience. Yeah. But I'm very close to both my boys. I'm very lucky.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. So, when you finally did then make that decision, you knew it was the right time. Was it that you were able to catch sight of this? You know, I'm always going on about, you know, it's not about whether, how much you're drinking or should you give up because you've got to. You really have to ask yourself this question: would my life be better physically and emotionally without it? And had you managed to catch sight at that point of a better life? And how did you go about it that next time then?
Well, I was writing a book called Starting Over, which I came out of the Big Brother house having had a horrendous experience. I should never have gone in. I won it, but it was a hollow victory. And the press were very unkind to me. And I had management who I thought were protecting me. And I thought were kind of trying to make me some money from car crashes, turning it into something that could keep me going and make me money. They were actually causing the car crashes. So unfortunately, I found this out. So I was in this awful situation, and Lincoln and I had met when I was still officially married. I wasn't being adulterous. Tim and I had agreed to separate. We just hadn't decided to tell people yet. So I was yet again, of course, accused of being this terrible adulteress, and that Tim was long-suffering Tim at home cradling our children. It's bollocks, and he knows that it is, but that's the narrative the press had chosen about me. And so I decided to announce the breakup of my marriage on television, on live television, so that I could take the control back from the press, as it were. Yeah. Basically saying, actually, hang on a minute, this is what's happening. And I was writing this book that had been thrust at me to do, called Starting Over. And I hadn't really started over, Janie. I was drinking while I was doing it. And it was just, but I still felt that I was more in control because I was writing this book called Starting Over. It was really ridiculous. But Lincoln and I, and I've said this before, so I'm not spilling any beans, but Lincoln and I, through this madness, as we called it, had managed to, because he also, basically, Lincoln is now an international selling artist. He's brilliant. He's got a thriving career, and I couldn't be more proud because of sobriety. When I met him, he was the PR and marketing manager for Stringfellows.
Oh, wow.
He was very successful, but of course living an incredibly nocturnal life. So his partying didn't start till 3 o'clock in the morning when he finished. He'd go round to Soho, and his friends would apparently go, "Here's Lincoln, let's get the needle on red." That's what they used to say, bang, like this. So his issues were different. His drinking was out of control, but he would then go for a run and go back in the club, and he was functioning and managing to do his job. And we met, the likelihood of it, you know, we met at 6 o'clock in the morning in a nightclub. He was 15 years younger than me. I mean, it doesn't make sense. But we managed to realize that we had something quite special. But when we drank to excess, we rowed and we got nasty with each other. I don't mean physically. Mm. This thing will happen one night, and the next morning I was rehearsing a play called Steel Magnolias. And it was early in the morning before I went to rehearsal. And I remember saying to him, we had this flat in Bermondsey, and I said, "I can't do this anymore. I can't love the person that you were last night." And he pushed back initially, as in, "Well, you've got a drink problem as well." You know, all of that stuff that goes on. And he was so worried about losing me. I get upset.
Yeah.
He was so worried about losing me, he gave up drinking that day, that minute. And I decided that I didn't have as much of a problem, because of course I was doing a play with these wonderful actresses like Shelley Lungi and Isla Blair and Cheryl Campbell, Casey Ainsworth. We were on tour in this really prestigious show, and I didn't really have that much of a problem because I could do the show and then have one glass of wine and go home. So it's quite interesting talking about it like this, actually. So there was one night that we were at Brighton Theatre Royal, and Lincoln at this time had given up Stringfellows, and he was kind of doing some marketing, but he was able to come around with me a bit and drive me to these different places, and I loved having him with me. And he said to me this one morning in Brighton at this hotel, Grand Hotel, he said, "God, you were really mean to me last night." And I went, "Oh, I wasn't, I only had two glasses of wine." He said, "Well, you had two glasses when you came off stage, then you had two glasses in the pub, mm-hmm. then we came back to the hotel and you had two glasses here. So you had a bottle and a half of wine." "Oh, you're counting me in drinks now," all of this. Anyway, culminated in, we did Richmond Theatre. We all decided to get some celebrity friends around, create a bit of a buzz, because it was the nearest we were going to be to London, and get a bit of publicity for the rest of the tour. So I remember Isla Blair invited Derek Jacobi, and I had Nanny Pat from the Only Way to Sussex Club. And it was this amazing cross-section of people. Anyway, I'd said to Lincoln, I've got two shows tomorrow, and I know the press are coming. So if I start to get drunk, will you just give me a little nudge? Lincoln goes, "Darling, I know the guy that you've just flirted with is gay, but the Pats are taking pictures through the window and they don't know that. So I'm just saying, you might want to tone it down." And the next morning, I was plastered over a newspaper in a red dress, pointing at Lincoln like this. And we'd got back to his flat in Kensington, and he had videoed me. And he basically said, I didn't look at the video. He basically said, I love you more than life itself, but I can't do this sober. And he came to pick me up at the theatre that night, and he drove me from Richmond to Kensington and told me how much he loved me, and how he didn't want to make me stop if I didn't want to. And I thought, I cannot let this person not know who is coming in the door at night. Mm-hmm. And we got back to the flat, sat in the car for 2 hours outside, and I've never had a drink from that night.
Wow. Amazing.
And it saved my life, Janie, you know.
Totally. But it's, what's so interesting again, you see, is that you, at that point, you stopped because you, in inverted commas, had to, you know, because of that crisis. But then I'm guessing over time, you started to see better life is.
Oh, God, Janie, I knew that I was in a desperate place. I mean, I knew that I was in a desperate place. The things I did to get alcohol, the thing that I mean, you know, this stuff I'll probably never talk about publicly, of course, because I've been, you know, more open than I guess some people would have been. But I knew that I was in a terrible, terrible, terrible situation, but I was so terrified of being without it.
Yeah. But you know? how was it for you when you stopped? Tell us some of the benefits that over time you found, and certainly how it affected your depression, because obviously it's, as you said, it doesn't cure depression.
I've got to get me old lady fan out. one of the things that I have loved the most is the respect. Mm-hmm. Is that I feel I can confidently say I'm an award-winning actress. A lot of that was forgotten about, and I don't mean that in a braggadly way. I just mean I'm very proud of my performances over the years, and that had completely been obliterated by my very public behaviour. Mm-hmm. And it was the self-respect that you get back, and the self-esteem, and the fact that, you know, when people are talking to you and respecting what you say and listening to what you say, that social side of it was huge to me.
Yeah.
And also, one of my main regrets is that my mum isn't alive to see my life now.
Yeah.
She died 3 weeks after I stopped drinking, and I take some solace from the fact that she knew I was on the right road.
Yeah.
I'm not religious, so that's all I can give it. But that she died knowing that I had stopped, because my mum had been a drinker. My mum had had some issues, different manifestations to mine, but my mum worried about me so much.
Yeah.
And the family and the kids, you know, and just giving them their lives back, giving them the fact that I give them wings and they can fly without worrying about me. And depression-wise, of course it doesn't cure depression, but it stops compounding the depression.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it stops compounding it. So now if I have an episode, blindsiding episode that comes at me like last September, touch wood, which was my last, I know that I've done everything in my power to keep that unwelcome visitor at bay. If he gets in, which he does, I have to wait for him to leave. But I know that he will undoubtedly leave a lot quicker than he would have when I was drinking.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Totally.
And I say to anybody who has, you know, I'm not the drink police. My friends all drink. Great. All I do is I go places and I leave early. You know, and they don't drink. I don't ask them not to drink around me, but they sometimes use a night out with us to not drink, you know, because they don't have a problem with it.
Mm.
And although I've become aware, and I'm sure you have, that there's a lot of our friends who think they don't have a problem.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And they absolutely do. And a lot of friends some friends whose marriages and relationships would be absolutely brilliant, but they're destroying them by their, I don't drink in the week, I just drink at weekends. Yeah, yeah, but at weekends you're blacking out and you're throwing things at each other.
Yeah.
You know, and of course my marriage, Lincoln and I have the most wonderful relationship.
Yeah.
And that might sound a bit soppy, but we do, Janie. And that's because of our sobriety.
And as you said as well, he's flying now, isn't he? And as you said, you said something earlier, you said, you know, he has this new stuff that he does because of sobriety. And I love the fact that people get, as you say, I love that expression, find your wings. People find that they have new hobbies, new careers. They write the book they've always wanted to write.
Oh
they travel. It's amazing.
I love that. And the thing is, you know, the thought of, we sometimes walk through Soho and we get that, we think, remember the fear. You know, the fear when you haven't had any sleep and it's the next day and everybody's normally going around their life, going to coffee shops and going to work, and you've still got the fear of the night before. And we are so grateful that our children can now look up to us. They accept that we had issues. We know we did things wrong. Lots of parents do things wrong. You can only apologize and try to move forward from that. But when people say, and I know a lot of people think they wouldn't be fun, oh my God, how boring are you when you're drunk?
Oh, how boring. Absolutely.
You're only fun to drunk people. You're the absolutely most boring people in the world. Absolutely kill me now. It's like, you know, totally. I know, Jean, but you've told me that 14 times.
Oh, I know.
14. Go away. I mean, Lincoln would be, Lincoln's tried to socially isolate for the last 8 years. He's happy in lockdown. He doesn't have to talk to people. And never has to go near a drunk person again.
Denise, we could talk for absolutely hours, but I want everyone to get your book if they haven't already. I just wonder whether you can give us any, and this sounds very flippant in the light of everything we've spoken about, but what would you suggest that people do who do suffer from depression on whatever level? You know, are there some things that you would recommend people putting in place? You know, what are the strategies that everyone can do? I mean, does walking in nature make a difference? Does the right nutrition make a difference? What about exercise? Are there any of those lifestyle things that can help?
All of those things are things that we should all be doing.
Yeah.
And those things help, I think, how long the unwelcome visitor stays.
Okay.
However, once depression is in, there is no amount of talking, walking, eating, that's gone. What you have to do is try to, my book is called Depression and How I Survive It. And it's about surviving and in surviving the visits and loving the times in between. So in the good times in between, try to eat well and try to get, even if it's just a walk, you know, and if you are a sufferer, try to take alcohol out of your life if you can. It is the most wonderful life without alcohol.
Yeah.
I know I had Lincoln, and I do know that is easier with somebody. The other thing is, when I was first poorly, there was nothing, as I say, except paragraphs like this in magazines. Now we have Google, and we can Google depression help, and there will be a group, a support group, a community, a person, because I know that getting professional help sometimes in the mental health system is hard, and now harder, but there will be somebody who will listen. And if you find that your GP or your family don't, look further afield. Yeah. Please don't think that you have anything to do with getting this illness. It's an illness like any other, and the unwelcome visitor always leaves.
Yeah, amazing. Wow, it's just been so fantastic to talk to you. I know that you know the book is just going to, you're going to have so much success with this. It's such
thank
important
you
work
so
that you're
much,
doing.
Jamie.
And thank you for being so candid, and it's just amazing to hear your story, just helping so many people. So I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank
Denise.
You, and I'll hook you up with Kevin and Claire.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
Brilliant.
Appreciate
lots
it.
Lots of love. Thanks, Jamie.
Bye.
Bye.
Great, wasn't she? Just fantastic. Just so amazing to just be willing to be that open and share all of this stuff. I really hope that Denise's book does fantastically well. I know that it will. If you are interested in joining us in the Sober Club, you know how to find us. We've got the video version of that interview for our Sober Club members so they can see us in our respective kitchens and doing the interview. Just check it out. It's thesoberclub.com. Coming up next week, we're back to an archive episode. I won't tell you exactly who it is yet. Thank you so much, by the way, for those of you that have dropped me an email or a message and told me what your favourite episodes are, because it's great to find out what people have really enjoyed. Loads of votes for Claire Pooley, obviously. Annie Grace, we did last week. Lots of votes for people who aren't necessarily so well known, but some of the things they said just gave you that light bulb moment. And really, with kind of, what is it, 82 episodes, there's lots to choose from. So do let me know your favourite podcast episodes. I'll still be really keen to hear those. We've got one more week, one more bit of opportunity to send me your sober story. I'm finally writing a book, and I'd love to pepper it through with some inspirational little stories. And it doesn't matter what stage you're at. It, you know, if you're literally just like the Sober Club, if you're new to all of this and you're only a few weeks in, or if you're 6, 7, 8 years sober, it really makes no difference. It's your experience that counts, and the benefits you've found, and perhaps any tips that you would share with other people, things that have worked for you along the way. But obviously the approach to the book is absolute positivity. So if you can share maybe some surprising benefits that you found when you ditched the booze, or any tips that you'd give for the early days, I'd absolutely love to hear them. So drop me a message or an email. You can find me at Janie Lee Grace pretty much everywhere. And obviously you can find me via thesoberclub.com. And more archive episodes to come. Naughty AF sparkling wine to give away. I'm also going to be speaking to Amanda, who's the founder of that brand, by the way, which is just absolutely the perfect, perfect drink for, I was going to say for a summer afternoon, but it's any time actually, isn't it? So I'll see you very soon, and have yourself a great week. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.